Beef hopefuls try out for Donald Trump, and should everyone just go to state schools? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, the Lapidary, Ramesh Panuru, and the Sage of Authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Made In, ExpressVPN, and The End of Everything, the new book by Victor Davis Hanson. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So Jim Garrity, Veep stakes now are really going on in earnest. We talked about it a little bit on Friday with regard to Kristi Noem's self-immolating memoir, where she talked about putting down poor Cricket. We talked a lot about that Friday, but there's a new element of the Kristi Noem campaign book that has risen to attention, the fact of a meeting with Kim Jong-un. It turns out, according to Kristi Noem's ghostwriter, at least, Kristi Noem is one of the few Americans ever to have set sight on Kim Jong-un in person, and she totally put him in his place, Jim. She knows how to deal with small tyrants because she's taught Sunday school or something of that nature. She went on the CBS Sunday show to talk about this over the weekend. And it has to be, I think, one of the worst Sunday appearances I've ever seen. What do you make of it?
What do I make of it? Well, I can hear listeners already saying, why are Jim and Rich still talking about it? Why are they always tearing down Republicans? Why do we always eat our own? Well, Kristi Noem keeps going out and talking about it. Like, if you want this story to go away, Kristi Noem has to stop going out and making absolutely absurd comments. You mentioned the Sunday show appearance in which she kept saying, "Well, I'm not going to talk about my meetings with foreign leaders." You brought it up, Kristi. It's in your book. She said that as soon as she was notified of this, she made the proper adjustments. So she read the audio book.
She read the audio book.
How is she reading this?
Didn't know what was in it.
How is she reading this and saying, and then when I met with Kim Jong-un, did I do that? Do I have amnesia? I don't remember that. But she just read it anyway. It goes out there. By the way, so there's no record of her ever meeting. You know, she went to the DMZ as a member of the House Armed Services Committee. There's no record of her meeting Kim Jong-un. What some people are speculating is that she met someone in South Korea and generally thought that was Kim Jong-un, which is kind of terrifying.
That's why she couldn't get any concessions out of him.
Like, it's just astonishing. But
he seemed like such a nice guy to me. You know, I don't know why he has this bad reputation.
Probably approved of her behavior.
Last night.
Yeah, exactly.
Last night, she goes on News Nation, is interviewed by Elizabeth Vargas, and, you know, Vargas asked the very basic question, didn't this seem weird when you were doing the narration for the audiobook for these anecdotes that you don't remember happening? And she was like, no, I'm not talking about my meetings with foreign leaders. So you're saying it didn't happen. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying the anecdote is wrong. I'm just saying we're taking it out. And it's not a retraction. First of all, you take it out of the book and don't put it in future editions. That is a retraction, right? That is, you know, that's when you take stuff out of a book, that's an indication. But the current position of Kristi Noem is that maybe she did meet with Kim Jong-un. She's not saying it's false, but she's taking it out of the book anyway. Like, why are we still kicking her when she's down? Because she keeps going out and doing things like this. At this point, she couldn't get elected dog catcher.
Yeah, so the book needs to be taken to a gravel pit and taken down. So Ramesh, their Sunday shows have been a means for people to try to audition for this role. There's a more direct one in Mar-a-Lago. We can get to that in a minute. But I thought the notable other Sunday show appearance, Tim Scott on Meet the Press, and he got hung up on whether he's going to accept the results of the 2024 election. You know, he's got to tap dance around this, obviously, if he wants to be Trump's VP pick. He didn't do it particularly deftly. And I just don't think, I wrote about this yesterday, Tim Scott does not fill me with a lot of confidence. I just don't think he's up for the level of intense scrutiny he'd get if he has this election, and then how difficult it would be to maneuver in this role if he actually becomes vice president of the United States. And then Doug Burgum got hung up on a similar thing with Jake Tapper, You know, Burgum said all the appropriate things about January 6th in the 2020 election in the immediate aftermath, not realizing that he'd run for president himself, lose to Donald Trump, and then continue to be relevant by getting right on the Trump train. So awkward for him as well, but I thought he handled it more deftly. What do you make of it?
You know, the thing is, throughout this whole process, Trump has not really demanded that other people join him in affirming that the election was stolen and rigged and that he won it in a landslide. So he doesn't require that you join him in the falsehood, but what you can't do is say the truth, which is that he lost and that he, you know, shamefully tried to overturn the legitimate results of an election. But in practice, when you're actually sitting in an interview, it's kind of hard to walk that line. They all try to do it. But I think it is particularly hard for somebody like Tim Scott, who I think is certainly doing his best to suppress his idealistic and truth-telling instincts. But I think sort of visibly chafes under the burden of doing it. And I think that if you're Trump, you're probably not impressed by this performance. And certainly if you are not him, if you are somebody who acknowledges the basic facts of the 2020 election, you're not going to be impressed either. But he didn't kill a dog.
There's a big cattle call down in Mar-a-Lago as well, Charlie.
On the Tim Scott point, the problem that these aspirants have is that this entire game is being played by capricious rules that are never quite clear, that none of them know what Trump expects. None of them know quite what to say because so much of this is built on lies. And none of them can anticipate whether or not they're going to be on the end of some blast on Truth Social, the weak rhino squish Tim Scott went on TV and wouldn't say this or would say that. And if you think about what is necessary for vice presidential aspirants or even vice presidents historically, it's to put aside the differences that they might have had during the primaries while they're vice president. So George H.W. Bush had to drop his dispute with Reagan over the Laffer curve or monetary policy while he was running and while he was vice president. You can do that. You know what that is. But this is really difficult because no one knows what Trump's looking for. No one knows what exactly it is that he wants them to say. I mean, you're right at one level, Rich, is that he doesn't seem to need people to go out and affirmatively lie. But the word seem is the key one there. You don't actually know what he wants in any given moment. So the people who are trying to get this job are debasing themselves, not just by being willing to put aside the truth, but by never actually knowing what it is that they're supposed to be saying at all. And so trying lots of different things out in public.
So, Jim, multi-barreled exit question. Just in terms of their possibilities for getting selected as Veep, we're going to go through a series of these candidates paired up. Who would you rather be? Katie Britt or Sarah Huckabee Sanders?
I think Katie Britt, yeah, everybody said she botched and did a lousy job with State of the Union response. She still represents youth, fresh face, relative unknown on the political scene. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, I feel like, is a known quantity, or at least a remembered quantity from her days as White House press secretary. Neither one comes from a particularly important state. I don't know if either one of them would move the dial dramatically. But I feel like Britt is, by being lesser known, is a bit more of a blank slate, and there could be more could be done to kind of shape her image more than you could do with Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Ramesh, Britt or Sanders?
Wait, we're not counting Noam anymore?
Even though I'll come to her.
She's
on a farm upstate with lots of room to run around now.
A series of pairings.
We'll go number of them. All right. Britt versus Sanders. I still think Britt. And I just, how to put this? There's no good way to put this, but I think that Trump, he has a vision, like literally there's mm-hmm. a set of characteristics he wants somebody to look like.
Look, yep, the look.
Yeah, and I think that Britt approximates that more than Sanders does.
Charlie.
I actually think the other way around. There's also no nice way of putting this. I think that Sarah Huckabee Sanders will be favored. I think she didn't blow the State of the Union response. I think she's less threatening than Katie Britt because she's less pretty to voters, that is. I think she also has proven herself to be loyal over time in a way that Katie Britt hasn't, even if she wanted to. I would much rather be Sarah Huckabee Sanders if I were hoping to be chosen.
I'm totally with Charlie. I endorse everything he said, but I don't discount, obviously, the look factor in terms of how Trump thinks about it. Jim, kind of long shots here. Byron Donalds or Lee Stefanik?
Can I just tell you, it's not going to be either one of those.
Ramesh.
It's not going to be either one of those. That they're not well known enough.
So, Stefanik, I think that there's going to be a lot of, I mean, Jim's right, but I do think that there's going to be a lot of Republicans around Trump and maybe Trump himself who think that he needs a woman on the ticket.
Charlie.
Yeah, I think Ramesh is right. I also, not that he would turn it down, but I think Byron Donalds wants to be governor of Florida, and I wonder how much work he's doing to get Trump to put him in a good position to run for that.
Jim is right, and Ramesh is also right. It's not going to be either of them, but you'd rather be Stefanik. All right, a more meaningful one, Jim. J.D. Vance or Marco Rubio?
So is the question, which one would be the better choice?
Which one would you rather be if you're angling to be Trump's vice presidential nominee, J.D. Vance or Marco Rubio?
It's very hard for me to disassociate my analysis of who's the better choice, and that is that if you can deal with the residency issue, Rubio's the better choice. If you're Trump, J.D. Vance is a really useful ally, but I think you'd rather have him in the Senate. I think he actually is pretty good at advancing the Trump agenda in a way there that I don't think Rubio's moved in a more nationalist, populist direction, but I think as a sheer campaigner, and winning over kind of the Trump skeptic voters, the Nikki Haley voters that are, you know, out there. I think Rubio does more for that and increases Trump's odds of winning the election.
Ramesh, Vance or Rubio?
Well, neither of them really balances him in that Vance just is an appeal to the harder core Trumpist than Trump himself. And Rubio has the geographic lack of balancing. As between the two, I think Vance makes sense just because of the residency thing. And I can't imagine Rubio, you know, moving to another state or declaring himself in another state. And I just can't imagine Trump doing that either.
The ultimate Rubio change, he kind of flip-flopped right. Whether he's in Florida or not. Charlie, Vance or Rubio?
He has to move to Tennessee and he instantly becomes country music loving, boot wearing Marco Rubio. I think that Rubio, residency issue notwithstanding, is far more likely than Vance. I don't, other than that he is something of a Trump sycophant and is in line with him on policy, I don't know why anyone thinks J.D. Vance would be in the running. He's just too much of a Trump product. He's a recursive Trump.
If you're a Trumpist, that's a feature, not a bug, right? I would say I agree with Jim. Rubio would be a really good choice, arguably the best choice, but the residency thing is just a major complication. Even if you can find a way around it, it would be embarrassing and still contentious. You know, if Trump's convicted in this New York case, there may be further attempts to kick Trump off the ballot. So then, so you actually want your number two, people saying he's not eligible as well. So I think those are major obstacles. And I just wouldn't sleep on J.D. Vance. I think his odds of being picked are a lot higher than some of the other names we hear a lot. Another meaningful pairing here, Jim, would you rather be Doug Burgum or Tim Scott?
Lately, I would say Burgum. It sounds like you're hearing that buzz. It sounds like Trump likes him, kind of like, and you're talking about somebody who balances out the Trump persona. Doug Burgum is even keeled and normal and boring in a good way. And I think that ends up being very reassuring for, as I said, all those Nikki Haley voters. I would point out that, like, Tim Scott, one of the things that I think makes him a very intriguing choice is that if Trump were to pick, every time Tim Scott has been in the national spotlight, we have seen self-professed anti-racist, wink, wink, progressive Democrats denounce him in the most hateful and racist ways, calling him an Uncle Tom, calling him an Oreo, et cetera, et cetera. So I have a, you know, if Trump picks him and the reaction from the Democratic Party is the most horrible racist stuff anybody's ever heard, then I actually kind of think that might actually help Trump. And so I think it could do some good. I don't know if that's a sufficient reason to pick him, but mm-hmm. I do think it's a very intriguing factor if Tim Scott were the selection. Mm-hmm.
Ramesh.
I think Tim Scott makes more sense than Burgum, notwithstanding that Burgum had a better Sunday show appearance than Scott. I think that there is some legitimate excitement in Republican circles around the idea of making a breakthrough among non-white voters this fall. And I think that's got to have some, that's got to have a lot of appeal to Trump and the political people around him. And Burgum just doesn't offer any advantages that way.
Charlie.
I would definitely think that Tim Scott would make more sense, but I think I would rather be Doug Burgum because I think the reporting on this has been solid. So I think Trump prefers Burgum.
I'd rather be Burgum. I don't find Scott hugely impressive. It wouldn't shock me if people who are going to be influential in this process have the same view. Burgum, you know, he's as safe can get, unless there's some horrible thing lurking that no one has any idea about and might do the most per, going back to Jim's point, to kind of help in the suburbs, absent a woman with some suburban appeal. So I'd rather be Burgum. Final pairing, Jim Garrity. Would you rather be Christy Noem or Cricket?
Look, as I mentioned, began this segment, I said that people were complaining that I had the audacity to write about this Monday when I should be letting the
these people didn't bother you at all, Jim. They didn't get under your skin at all, these people.
No, but here's the thing. So, like, you know, people have asking legitimately, why is Christy Noem going out doing these TV appearances and keeping the story alive? I'm just glad she's keeping something alive.
Ramesh.
Well, I've heard that all dogs go to heaven, so I think I'd rather be Cricket.
Charlie.
Would I rather be a dog who's been shot in a gravel pit? Or no.
I'd rather be Christy. The funny thing is that this is not an easy choice. We're sitting here contemplating.
It is an easy choice. Sorry, it is an easy choice. I don't wish to be a dog who's been shot in a gravel pit.
So Christy Noem, wow.
Yes, Christy Noem, who is alive and a human.
I think if we workshop this a little, we're going to have a solid slogan for Christy Noem.
I mean, if you really like life, the question is fairly obvious in any context. Would I rather be Jeffrey Dahmer? Yeah, probably.
Christy Noem 2024, till the last dog dies.
This is going to end with her doing cameos, offering to kill your dog for you.
Now you know why those Sarah McLachlan commercials were always so sad.
What was the Babylon Bee headline? Had her with the image with a shotgun, and Christy Noem goes to Kentucky Derby just in case there are any horses that need to be put down. So I'd rather be Cricket. Cricket's living on in memory, an honorable memory, honored more in death than in life, unfortunately.
You know, after this episode and on the back of the last one, she might oblige you if you ask nicely. I'm sure she's not a fan of you right now.
So with that, let's hear from our first sponsor of this episode, Made In Cookware. Did you know that most of the dishes in Tom Coluccio's craft restaurant are made in made-in pots and pans? The braised short ribs? Made and made in. The Rohan duck? Made and made in. The heritage pork chop? You got it. Made and made in, which isn't surprising. Made In has been supplying top chefs and restaurants with high-end cookware for years for the simple reason that Made In makes exactly what demanding chefs are looking for. Their carbon steel cookware, for example, combines the best of cast iron and stainless clad, gets super hot, and is rugged enough for grills or an open flame. Best of all, Made In is sold online, so their professional-grade cookware is far more affordable than other high-end brands. If you want to take your cooking to the next level, remember what so many great dishes on menus all around the world have in common. They're made and made in. I'm not sure here in the Lowry household we are making many great dishes, but we are making them in a great pan from Made In. You just pick up their stuff. You can feel it's finely wrought. Feels great. To handle, cooks evenly, and is very easy to clean. Right now, you can save up to 25% this Memorial Day from the 18th until the 27th. Visit madeincookware.com. That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com. It's great stuff. I guarantee you will not regret it. So please check it out. So Ramesh, we have events in Israel. Appears it's murky. We'll have to wait, but that an operation in Rafah has begun. This is, of course, has been the Biden administration's red line. Has been the Biden administration's red line. There've been reports, I'm not sure how accurate they are, that the Biden administration has been so serious about this that they have even delayed weapons shipments or paused weapons shipments to Israel. What do you make of it?
There is some speculation, particularly among people who are anti-Israel, that the administration's playing a double game here and has been sort of publicly cautioning against this incursion, but as privately doesn't really care all that much. And I think there is a little bit of that because there are multiple audiences that they are addressing. But off the record, what you hear from the administration has been pretty consistently strong opposition to the incursion. And I wonder if just to get crassly political here for a minute, if this wasn't a political mistake, in that I just think this administration, this president is better off with this over faster.
Absolutely.
And this was not going to ultimately, it might slow Israel down, but it was not going to stop Israel from doing what it thought was necessary for its security interests. And so all that they've done, arguably, is just drag this out and bring it closer to the election and allow the pain inside their coalition to continue. And incidentally, I mean, if that's right, I mean, right, if you assume that this operation would have gone forward faster without all of the foot dragging by the administration, it's probably made the humanitarian situation worse as well. It's made it harder for the crisis to end for Gazans.
So Charlie, we also had this back and forth yesterday when this operation was beginning, where Hamas suddenly was accepting a ceasefire deal, which is transparently an effort to stay Israel's hand. And obviously this is really crucial to Hamas because this is their last stronghold in Gaza, and if they can stop Israel from taking it, well, maybe they've survived in some form as a fighting force.
The most remarkable part of what has happened in the Middle East between October 7th and now, to me, as something of a naive, I accept, is the hand that has been played by those who, for whatever reason, wish to protect Hamas. If you look at this on paper, you have Israel with weapons and, it seems, the resolve to respond. And you have Hamas at Israel's mercy. And yet Hamas has managed to play the one card it had, which is the propaganda card, in a way that I would never have imagined possible. And leave aside what we've talked about a great deal, which is the protests in the United States on college campuses. Just the manner in which these disingenuous offers, the very notion that these offers are worth anything, that they're in a position, having done what they did, to negotiate, is remarkable. And has made inroads into the White House that indulges them, and into the press, which reports on them as if they're legitimate. It seems not going to work. The Israelis are going to do what they said they would do at the outset. But I did not expect it to take this long, to be this much of a slog, to be gummed up in the way that it has been by international opinion. I think if you go back to when we first discussed this on this podcast, you asked Rich how long it would take before international opinion shifted. And I said it would be very quick. So in one sense, I suppose I saw this coming. But when I said that, I was imagining loud denunciations from the UN or France or Germany. I didn't expect to see the protests we've seen in the United States. I didn't expect to see the White House behaviors it has. I didn't expect the both sides-ism from the media. The game that has been played here has been remarkable. Now, it is coming to an end, but it has really made me rethink how effective you can be with almost no power.
Yeah, Jim, so there's this drumbeat, the kind of way to launder anti-Israel opinion among respectable or so-called respectable Democrats. We saw this with Chuck Schumer, is to make it all about Bibi Netanyahu. Like, there is this pogrom against Israel on October 7th, and then Bibi Netanyahu just decided on his own, wow, we need to wage a war against Hamas to destroy it. And all these terrible things have happened because of Bibi Netanyahu. And if Bibi Netanyahu went away, the Israelis are like, okay, no, we won't go into Rafah. Forget it. You know, leaving residual Hamas forces there is fine. That was all just Bibi's idea. But of course, this is a society-wide a decision on the part of Israel that it can't tolerate this again, and it won't. So Israel, Netanyahu could get run over by a bus, and his successor could be run over by a bus, and the next prime minister after that run over a bus, and the fourth choice, sort of the Mike Johnson of Israel, would still be doing want to do this.
Yeah, when I speak to U.S. liberal progressive friends, they tend to believe that if Netanyahu stepped down or had a heart attack or something, that suddenly Israel would change its positions on a whole host of issues. And I just don't think that's the case. There's no reason to think, like, it is a serious misreading of Israeli public opinion. Maybe the details, maybe the tweaking around the edges. But no, the other thing, which this last couple of days, was full of, urine and vinegar this morning when I was writing the Morning Jolt. Who do you have to be to believe Hamas at this point? When Hamas says something, to say, I'll take them at their word. That's pretty reliable. Because yesterday, right around midday Eastern time, Hamas announces, we accept the ceasefire. And everybody, that's the headline that went around far and wide, all kinds of news organizations. Our distinguished colleague, Phil Klein, says, wait a minute, watch this very carefully. We'll see if they actually mean this. Keep in mind, Hamas has broken every previous ceasefire. But he's saying what this sounds like, what Phil could figure out through great insight and or telepathy was the recognition that Hamas had not actually agreed to the ceasefire proposal on the table from the Israelis and the U.S. They had invented their own ceasefire with minor wording changes, as the New York Times had put it. Let's point out that one of the minor wording changes was from, we're going to give you 33 living hostages, to 33 hostages, maybe a bunch of them are dead. That strikes me as a pretty important difference. That strikes me as literally it's a matter of life and death. That does not strike me as a minor wording change. And kudos to That was the previous wording of the of that. Peter Baker of the New York Times accurately reported this morning saying Hamas did not accept a ceasefire deal so much as make a counteroffer. Now, what's really troubling about this is the Israelis are saying that, you know, the U.S. knew this was the counteroffer and could have said, whoa, 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 guys, that's a very different offer. This we do not have a ceasefire. And instead, at minimum, they could have given the Israelis a heads up. Hey, Hamas is going to say that they've accepted a ceasefire, but they mean this totally different deal. And the Biden administration, U.S. negotiators did not do that. Israel feels really blindsided here. So now the question is, are we doing everything we can to help Hamas spread this narrative, in which they're the reasonable ones? They're the ones who have agreed to the ceasefire, and those dastardly, stubborn, warmongering Israelis have chosen to go into Rafah anyway. We started out this on October 8th with a U.S. policy that was trying to protect Israelis from the wrath of Hamas. Now our policies functionally are trying to protect Hamas from the wrath of the Israelis.
So Ramesh asks a question to you. Israel is winning the war because it has killed so many Hamas fighters, or is losing the war because international opinion has turned so strongly against it?
You know, when Jim was talking, I was thinking of the line from Game of Thrones where I think somebody says money is power, and the response, no, power is power. And I think Israel is demonstrating that Israel's winning.
Charlie?
I agree with that entirely.
Jim?
Repeat the question because I want to make sure my answer is precise.
Yeah, no problem. So is Israel winning because it's wrought such destruction on Hamas, or is it losing because international opinion has turned so strongly against it?
It is win. If Hamas is winning, a whole bunch of their guys aren't going to make it to the medal ceremony. So yes, in that sense, Israel is winning. But I really, what I saw yesterday in the paper, the headlines was just such a phenomenally successful information operation by Hamas that I found it really disturbing. And the idea of, oh, big mean Israel is picking on those poor Hamas guys who are being so reasonable. So Israel's winning in the way that really counts, but we should not dismiss or poo-poo what Hamas has managed to pull off in the last couple of days.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think Israel's winning, but it has come at significant cost in that respect. So Charlie, our second sponsor is ExpressVPN. Over to you.
Indeed, it is ExpressVPN, which I use myself on pretty much all my devices. So let me ask you something. What if there was someone out there who kept a log of every single thing you did, every minute of the day? That would be pretty creepy. Well, I'm afraid that is exactly what happens every time you go online. Your internet provider is allowed to store logs of every website you've ever visited. And that isn't great. So if you want to avoid that, then you should use ExpressVPN. Now, this is a very clever system. What it does, it reroutes your internet connection through ExpressVPN's secure servers so that your internet provider can't see or log what you do online. All they know is you're connected to ExpressVPN. The rest vanishes and is not logged. Now, some of you think, well, if I'm routing all my data through a VPN, then doesn't that mean the VPN will just see what I'm doing and log my data instead and take advantage of it? And yes, sometimes many VPNs claim to have a no-logs policy, but they have been caught logging customer activity nevertheless. But ExpressVPN doesn't do that. And in fact, that's why I use it, because it has trusted server technology. They were the first major VPN provider to engineer all of their VPN servers to run on RAM only. That makes it impossible, because the storage is transient, for their VPN service to store any data, including logs of any customer. And you don't have to take my word for this. ExpressVPN is so confident in their no logs claim, they even had one of the biggest assurance firms, PricewaterhouseCoopers, audit their technology. And that's why CNET and The Verge named ExpressVPN the number one VPN in the world. So if you too want to stop letting people keep logs of what you do online, visit expressvpn.com/editors right now and find out how you can get 3 months free. That's expressvpn.com/editors.
Thank you, Charlie. So, Charlie, let's stick with you. We have these conservative judges saying they will not hire Columbia grads, which plays into a broader theme, which is the collapsing image of Ivy League schools. And this seems likely to drive another jag down in that regard. And then you have Nate Silver, the data analyst and polling maven, who's been writing over the last week or so very intensely about don't go to an Ivy League school. There's no reason to go to an Ivy League school. Their reputations are going to be further tarnished by this. Just go to a state school. There's no significant disadvantage, and now I'm upsized to going to a state school. What are your thoughts?
Well, I can certainly see the argument. I think it might be too early to tell. I also think that we're going to need to separate out students by what they're studying. It seems likely to me that there is still an advantage, for example, to going to MIT if you're an engineer or want to be one. And I don't see the networking effect that Ivy League universities generate being diminished quite yet. But as a prediction for the future, or as advice for the average student, I think there is a lot to that. There's been a lot to that for quite a while, though. The protests that we have seen, the awful testimony from higher-ups at these colleges that we have seen have made this perhaps more obvious. But I've been writing for a long time asking the question, is it obvious to anyone that the people who come out of Harvard and Yale and Princeton and, yes, Oxford are necessarily impressive? Is there anything about them as citizens that you necessarily admire? And I don't think that there is. So I think it's a difficult one to answer because I think it does depend on what you're studying. I think we haven't yet seen the reduction in the primary benefit of going to a famous university, which is to be around other people who are intelligent and self-starters and who will probably go on to get jobs that will be useful to you. But I do think we're beginning to see that shift. And in some sense, the student loan question that we've talked a lot about and that animates me is related to this, because that is a problem that has resulted from the universities not providing the value that students have been told or expected that they would. And that also is going to change the way that students and parents look at colleges in the long run. You cannot bail out an industry that doesn't do what it says it will do forever. If, for example, and I understand this is a separate question, but if the NFL became boring, you could for a while fix it with subsidies and encourage people to go and watch it at a price that they didn't bear themselves. But it wouldn't work forever. Eventually, the sport would die. And that's the other side of this that is independent of the sort of ideological question that is a huge warning bell, I think, that we have created a situation in which the federal government has to say, no, keep going and we'll pick up some of the tab. Well, why, if universities are as useful as they're supposed to be?
So, Jim, what do you think of the letter from these judges? I support anything in theory that puts pressure on Columbia and highlights how disgracefully it's handled itself here. But there are a lot of good kids at Columbia, and National Review, you know, for decades now has hired a lot of people out of Ivy League schools who have become more impressive by the fact that they've had to fight, you know, as a minority and stand up for their ideological minority and stand up for their beliefs and found, you know, alternative publications and all the rest of it. So, you know, if there's a blanket policy that no one from Dartmouth would be hired, you know, 40 years ago, maybe some people think this is a good thing, but, you know, there wouldn't be Dinesh D'Souza and a whole class of conservative opinion makers who've been very influential the last several decades. But, you know, really, is that, let's say, the kid who, in the green shirt who was resisting the mob at Columbia when they're trying to take Hamilton Hall, really? I don't know, he's a law student, but if he is, he shouldn't get hired by a conservative judge because he goes to Columbia?
I was going to say, I think these judges have their hearts in the right place and they want to stand for the right values. I think the way they're going about it is flawed. And by the way, we also should note, it's 11 judges, right?
13.
13 judges. If 13 judges sign their name to a letter like this, there's a lot more than 13 judges who are probably thinking this way. And so these are 13 who are willing to say, I'm not going to hire anybody from Columbia. The reputational damage to Columbia is done. And that there are probably, you know, because like, you know, I was joking that if your neighbor up before this year, if your neighbor said, oh, great news, my daughter got into Columbia. You're like, oh my God, it's fantastic. It's great. She is on the right path. And now you're like, oh, Columbia. Did she get turned down from a state school? Did she, you know, sorry, you know. Semi-seriously, you know, so these, and as you noted, also it starts for people who are entering Columbia's class of 2024, it sounds like. So like literally it's high school kids who they are saying, I'm not going to hire. And like the high school kids weren't on campus. What are you blaming them for? They're not the ones who are the problem. I think a more accurate one would be, if you apply for a clerkship or you apply for a job in this office, we're going to see if you had any, you know, connection to these protests. And if you did, there's probably somebody else who's equally qualified who didn't harass Jewish students and who didn't storm it. Oh, by the way, there's probably some kid who didn't misspell Palestine as they did at a big sign at the very best and brightest America. You know, 9% acceptance rate, $80,000 a year. Yeah. So I don't mind employers saying, hey, Columbia, you have inflicted an enormous amount of damage to your reputation, which is, oh, by the way, one of the reasons you can charge that enormous tuition. And if you don't have that, nobody's going to want to go to Columbia anymore. And right now, the other thing is many of us who are in the, you know, college shopping stage of our lives for our children, look around and wonder, are they really taking the best and brightest? Or do they put their thumb on the scale, not just for the legacies and all the other, you know, criteria, but do they do it for the activist class? And if you write an entrance essay about how you stood up to the patriarchy and all that kind of stuff, do they take that kid over the kid who's got perfect SAT scores and really great stuff like that? Like, look, we don't know. It's this big black box what's going on in these admissions offices. But certainly, it does not look like Columbia has been taking, you know, really smart kids. They look like kids who don't know anything about international affairs, don't even understand how college endowments work, because it's less than, you know, it's six-figure sums in a $13 billion endowment. They don't understand how international finance works. They don't understand how index funds. Nobody understands any of these things. They're just angry and they just want to harass Jewish kids. So why shouldn't Columbia have some great reputational value? That said, if you want to punish folks, you should punish the folks who are directly responsible, not the kids who got into Columbia this year and have nothing to do with what happened in the protests on the Quad this year.
Yes, sir, Mesh, there's definitely a huge element of these student bodies that are coddled. You know, that you had law students saying, we've been so traumatized by the fact that there was this relatively small encampment on campus that had to be arrested twice and broke into a building for a while. We can't finish our work, you know. and there was one professor I saw on Twitter who said a week or so ago, all your work is done. I don't know whether this was at the law school. I think it was probably just at the rest of the school. But they said, all your work's done in this class. You don't need to do any more and you all get A's. I mean, what a disgraceful abdication. I think back to my late father, who was a English professor, and you know, he'd haul these blue books into his study, you know, and hate every minute of it, but read faithfully all these papers and grade them. The idea, if you told him that he had to give everyone an A in his class, he'd say, no way, he'd quit first.
Well, I think that if you are a law student who is using the encampments as a kind of long shot argument that just might pay off to get you out of finals, that's a sign that you're a good lawyer. And this is what, in fact, Columbia is training you for. I think that the universities are suffering some reputational damage here, but it would be a mistake to overestimate how much. I think you know, people are still going to be applying. I don't think that they're going to have to increase their admissions rates a lot. As for the judges, I think that the arguments made at the beginning of the letter about how disgraceful the university's conduct has been, I think are sound, but they don't really supply a lot of connective tissue as to why it therefore follows that they should do what they are proposing to do. When they've talked about boycotting Yale Law School in the past, there was at least a little bit of a tighter connection to the idea that, you know, what's going on at Yale Law School suggests maybe they're not getting the kind of education that we want them to get. This is, I think, a little bit more attenuated, and the kind of the object is to put pressure on Columbia. I'm not sure that it does put all that much pressure on Columbia. And meanwhile, the collateral damage is basically Federalist Society kids at Columbia Law School who don't really deserve to have their prospects diminished. Although, of course, there are plenty of other federal judges that they can go to.
Yeah. So, Charlie, next question to you. You're an employer, and you get two job applications, one from a kid from a state school, one from a kid from an Ivy League school. Do you, despite everything you might believe, kind of implicitly come in with an assumption, oh, this Ivy League kid is going to be more impressive, or no?
I think I would, but less so than 10 years ago and less so than 3 years ago as well. As I say, I think that's going to take time to change. So yes, I think I would still think that.
Jim?
Depending on where I'm working, if I've got some institution where I really want to succeed, I'll be honest, I'd be very tempted to give the state school kid the shot, because I feel like you'd want to read more about that resume, you want to read more about that background. But the assumption is the kid who went to the Ivy League is going to have just no shortage of opportunities ahead of him, and then maybe I can help somebody who's been overlooked a bit with that state school. Maybe I'm bringing my baggage to that. I don't know, but I have a sneaking suspicion that the state school kid didn't have, because it isn't going to have the Harvard Mafia working for him to open up other doors for him.
Ramesh.
Well, Princeton had a pretty terrific class of 1995, and
this is why Ramesh got hired at NR originally. Is this bias?
And it's on track to have a pretty good class of 2027 as well. What I hear from my daughter, so I might just have to recuse myself from this question. But I think it does. I think it does mean something, but you can make too much of it. And it should not be one of the top reasons you make your choice.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, you assume, and this is my experience at NR, there's certain the Ivy League kids, you can assume there's a certain level of talent there, but that doesn't mean they're going to be necessarily impressive people or good at any given job that you're hiring for, or be better than anyone from a no-name school. So it's a little, it's a little, tips them a little favorably in your initial impressions, just looking at a resume. But the end of the day, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. With that, let's hear from our third sponsor of this episode, new from Victor Davis Hanson, the New York Times bestselling author of The Dying Citizen, The Case for Trump Comes, The End of Everything, How Wars Descend into Annihilation. And the End of Everything, military historian Victor Davis Hanson charts how and why societies from ancient Greek to the modern era choose to utterly destroy their foes, and delivers a sobering call to contemporary readers to heed the lessons of obliteration, lest we blunder into catastrophe once more. Former U.S. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster calls The End of Everything compelling and says it helps us recognize the urgency of trying to prevent our own demise. New York Times bestselling historian Andrew Roberts calls it a stupendous book and a must read. The End of Everything by Victor Davis Hanson is on sale today, May 7th, wherever books are sold. I have not seen it yet myself, but I'm very much looking forward to it. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Jim Garrity, you've been watching some action movies lately.
Yeah, I am 2 for 2 so far this summer. I'm pleasantly surprised by that. First was Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. I actually have the book. Not that people are seeing the video version here, but I'm holding it up right now. The trailer is perfect. Just imagine a fun action movie about one of the first British commando units taking on the Nazis in parts of Africa. Except just be ready for a movie that features more on-screen deaths of Nazis than actually Nazis who died in the war. It is very violent. It is cheerfully violent. It is gleefully violent. Kind of like Inglourious Bastards, but maybe kind of a little more fun. And then this past weekend, I saw The Fall Guy. If you saw the trailer, I think you get the idea of the gist. It's action, it's fun, it's romance. Fun popcorn flicks that I think is what summer, how you want to spend a hot summer day in an air-conditioned theater. So feeling pretty good so far, 2 for 2.
All right, so Ramesh, you've been listening to the album Songs About Lincoln.
Yeah, it's kind of an odd idea, really. Adam Tressler has done this album of exactly what it sounds like, songs about Lincoln and songs about bit players in Lincoln's life, from Mary Surratt to Boston Corbett. And at first you'd listen thinking, well, this is kind of an interesting idea, but it turns out to be pretty good. I don't know if I'm going to check out his album on William McKinley. No, there really is one. It's like, I think it's called Lesser Known President, but Songs About Lincoln, I'm enjoying it.
Awesome. So Charlie, you went to see a Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp game.
I did on Sunday. It was a beautiful day and it was nice and cool and breezy as well. The reason that we went, although we do sometimes go on a whim, was that the Yankees farm team was in town, the Rail Riders. They did, unfortunately. Well, I say unfortunately, I was sort of mixed being a Yankees fan, but they did beat the Jumbo Shrimp and had beaten the Jumbo Shrimp 4 times in a row before that as well. It was a good day out. We got to sit right behind home plate, although we moved over a few seats because right behind home plate, weirdly enough, you can't drink beer in the 8 seats.
So why is that? Because if people get, they'll be on TV and get too crazy, or what's?
I don't know. It's a good question. It's a family section, but if you go a little bit over, and there were seats there that were unoccupied, then you can have your beer. So we just moved 4 over and left the kids behind home plate. I mean, they were right next to us. Anyhow, it was a terrific day out. But I did, as I said to you beforehand, keep looking longingly over at TIAA Bank Field, where the Jacksonville Jaguars play ahead of this year's season.
They can look forward to watching the NFL game there.
And, the game.
Several months, yeah, the game. So I came into possession some Coca-Cola in the mini green bottles, and I'm a big fan of Coke, regular Coke, and I've thought the optimal vehicle for drinking Coke is to get a can of Coke and pour it into a glass with ice. And that's the best way to drink Coke. But straight from one of these green bottles is not bad either. Brings back memories when I was a kid and I go to my grandmother's and, she, like all grandmothers, she was spoiling me. I wasn't supposed to have soda, but she'd have these ice cold greenish bottles, green tinted bottles of Coke, and she'd crack them open and you'd hear that fizz, and she had Paul Harvey on the radio in her little kitchen in her apartment. So this is a good way to drink Coke as well. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
I'm going to go with Stanley Kurtz, a corner post called Stop Greenlighting High School Walkouts. This has actually been an issue in our corner of Authenticity Woods. Basically, starting back in October, after the Hamas attack on Israel, there were students who wanted to walk out in support of Israel. and there were students who wanted to walk out in protest of Israel. And generally the schools had, they last only like 15 to 20 minutes, so they're not missing a ton of class time. But you know, Stanley's argument is that schools should not be encouraging this in any way. You want to do this before school, do this after school, during school hours, you belong in school. I think it's a very strong argument. Everybody should read that.
Ramesh, what's your pick?
As the print guy here, I am bound to promote in our new issue some of the great essays. And we've got one by Fred Bauer. If you've heard a little bit or even a lot about a very online character called Bronze Age Pervert, read this essay. I think it's the only thing you have to read about this. If you read anything about the Bronze Age Pervert, read this.
Charlie.
I thought you were, for a second, going to pick the same piece as me, Ramesh. I want to highlight Waiting for Caesar by, how do I pronounce it, Philip Wallach. This is, in a sense, related to Bronze Age Pervert in that it describes this new right longing for authoritarians and the belief, ultimately, that Americans are unable to govern themselves, or at least that the threat from the left is such that in order to prevail, we need to give up the Constitution. It's an extended response to a book by Michael Anton and a separate book by Patrick Deneen, in effect. And it's imperative because there is no point in us beating away the authoritarian instincts on the left just to let them in on the right. And this piece makes that case persuasively.
So my pick is our editorial against Ron DeSantis' ban of lab-grown meat. You may not like lab-grown meat. I've never had any myself. You may hate the idea of lab-grown meat. You may realize that there is an element of the elite that's basically conspiring to impose lab-grown meat on people, but none of that adds up to a ban on lab-grown meat making sense, and the editorial makes that case very compellingly. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National U podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National U Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Ramesh. Thank you, Jim. Thanks to Made In, ExpressVPN, and The End of Everything, the new book from Victor Davis Hanson. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.